Welcome to all of our listeners on CJTR Community Radio at 91.3 FM, and welcome to everyone tuning in over the internet at cjtr.ca. Wherever across the globe you may be, welcome to Human Rights Radio, hosted weekly from Regina, Saskatchewan, Canada, by Amnesty International volunteers Jim Hutchings and Mona Hill, who are part of a worldwide movement of people dedicated to the promotion of human rights and the safety of all human beings. We're working to build a world in which every person enjoys the rights included in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and other human rights standards. Thanks to Canadian band Mr. Something Something from Toronto and the Afrobeat poet Ikwunga for our theme song, You Are Beautiful. My name is Jim Hutchings. My co-host is Mona Hill. Today, we have the honor of introducing Craig Benjamin, coordinator of research and campaigning on the human rights of Indigenous peoples for Amnesty International Canada, English-speaking section. His dedicated work over the past 13 years has included the coordination of the Stolen Sisters campaign and working with communities such as Grassy Narrows and the Lupicon Cree, and follow-up to Ontario's Iprawash inquiry. Craig represented Amnesty International in the final years of negotiation of the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples at the United Nations. Before joining Amnesty, Craig worked for Indigenous Peoples organizations in Canada, the U.S., Latin America, and Asia. Craig is a father, a former journalist, and one-time farmer whose family lives in Nova Scotia. Welcome, Craig.
Yes, welcome, Craig.
Thank you very much.
It's good to have you here with us. It's been a long journey for you, coming halfway across the country. And you've been here for a couple of days already, haven't you?
For a couple of days, yeah.
And what kind of adventures have you had since you got here?
Oh, it's been really, really positive opportunity to meet people in quite a few communities. One of the most exciting and rewarding things was an opportunity to travel up to Fort Capel, where we met with students in the Treaty 4 Education Success Program. And it was really exciting to speak with young people mm-hmm. about the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples and their future and seeing their future, you know, fulfilled and raised up through the observance of these international human rights standards.
How many students were there?
I think around 300.
Wow, that's a lot. They came from schools from all around sort of different reserves. So.
Yes.
That's wonderful. So you were at the Treaty 4 area, and you've been back in town, and you're here tonight, and you're going to be going to Saskatoon.
Saskatoon for a regional amnesty meeting.
Right.
Over the weekend, yeah.
That's on Saturday. Actually, I think it's Friday night and Saturday, and some people from Regina are going to be going up there on Saturday morning. So we did mention that Craig was in on the formation towards the end, right, of the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People. We do have some booklets here, and during the break, if you want to take your own booklet or take a few, you're welcome to. Let's talk about that, Craig.
Sure.
Go for it. Tell us about where you came in on it and how you ended up getting involved in it.
Well, in many ways, we came in toward the end. The UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples was developed over a period of more than two decades. And one of the things that's absolutely extraordinary about the Declaration is in comparison to other human rights instruments, which are essentially crafted by the governments of the world, the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples is the first international human rights instrument that the people whose own rights were at stake got to sit down, you know, on the other side of the table from governments and to be able to express to governments the kinds of human rights protections that they needed, and to actually actively negotiate and ensure that they achieved a declaration that met those needs. And it was really an extraordinary achievement. I said it took more than two decades. There's an indication of how hard a struggle this was. And Indigenous peoples organizations from around the world, year after year, sent people to participate in these negotiations. And over the course of those negotiations, bit by bit, states came to realize and accept both the need for the declaration and also the expertise that Indigenous peoples brought to the table as advocates for their own rights. And I think it not only is the declaration important for meeting the very urgent needs of Indigenous peoples around the world, Indigenous peoples who are almost universally around the world, the most disadvantaged, the most marginalized, the most impoverished, the most victimized members of their society. The Declaration is so urgent for those very real needs. But it also sets a model for the future, a model of understanding human rights not as imposed from the top down or not as conceptualized from the top down, but as understood from the very experience of the people whose rights are to be protected, and ensuring that those experiences are reflected in the kinds of protections that are afforded.
I think the importance of that does not go unnoticed. And one of the things I was thinking about was when you talked about the need for the Declaration as coming from the grassroots up, is most countries have their own human rights codes. And I've heard the argument, particularly from our own government in the past, that we have a human rights code that should cover every citizen of the country. And that, as some of you may know, the Declaration was just recently signed. It was about a year ago, wasn't it? By our government, which was one of the last countries to come in on it, even though we were in on the formation of it with the previous government.
Well, the reason we have international human rights standards is because we cannot rely on the national legislation, national human rights instruments alone to fulfill and protect the rights, especially of the most vulnerable and the most marginalized. I think nowhere is that more true than in respect to indigenous peoples. The very essence of the human rights violations faced by indigenous peoples is the fact that their very existence may be denied by the states under which they live, and certainly quite profoundly their most basic rights, their rights to decide their own future, the right of self-determination, the rights to their own lands and resources by which they can provide for themselves, provide for their families, and practice their way of life. These rights have been so systematically denied by governments, even governments that have on paper quite fine human rights standards of their own, quite fine human rights instruments, we see the systematic violation of the rights of indigenous peoples. I think that the Declaration is a clear example of why we do need to be able to to press states to transcend the limitations of their national legislation, hold them to a higher standard. The situation across the world is the case that there are indigenous peoples who live in some countries where they are afforded absolutely no protection under domestic law. The opposite is true. To even describe yourself as an indigenous person is to run the risk of being categorized as a terrorist, as a threat to the state. There are other countries that have a very fine-sounding laws that have constitutional-level protection and recognition of the rights of indigenous peoples, yet in practical reality, you see that the continued grave violation of the very rights that the governments are sworn to uphold at the highest level. And I think that Canada is a really interesting example in this instance, because we do have very, very fine and advanced human rights institutions at the domestic level in Canada. We do have constitutional recognition of the rights of indigenous peoples. We have a long history of treaty making on a nation-to-nation basis with indigenous peoples. We have a robust court system that has repeatedly made rulings recognizing the rights of indigenous peoples. And yet, if we look at the concrete daily reality, we see a profound gap in the enjoyment of human rights between Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal people in Canada. We see a failure to uphold those very laws when it comes to Indigenous peoples. And we see even when there's an acknowledged injustice, for example, when there's a government acknowledgement that land has been wrongfully taken from an Indigenous group, from an Indigenous nation, we see the government devoting its resources to fight tooth and nail against returning that land, and in the meantime telling non-Indigenous population that it's business as usual and they should just go ahead and continue using that land as if there's no other claimants to it. And this is in a country where we're all quite proud to say to the world that we're champions of human rights. So, if even here, even in Canada, we see this kind of systematic violation of the rights of Indigenous peoples, it just tells us why we need to have an international standard that we can always call governments to live up to that higher standard.
Okay, so if you would like to, you mentioned an issue such as land rights. Are there any specific examples that you could give us that maybe you have worked on in Canada? And I know that you worked on some issues overseas as well.
Hmm. Well, I'll give you two examples because they're on the two poles of a trade agreement. Canada's recently entered into a free trade agreement with the government of Colombia. So Colombia is a government like Canada that has a constitution. In the constitution, there is recognition of the rights of indigenous peoples as well as Afro-Colombians. Despite this constitutional protection, we see the wholesale uprooting of indigenous peoples from their lands. Well, we see indigenous peoples exposed to grave, to horrendous violations at the hands of armed opposition groups, at the hands of paramilitary groups acting with the tacit approval of the state, at the hands of the army, to such an extent that the Colombian Constitutional Court has said that there are at least 32 distinct indigenous nations in Colombia, 32 distinct peoples, 32 distinct histories, cultures, languages, ways of being that are on the verge of utter eradication. As a consequence primarily of three things: as a consequence of the armed conflict on their land, as a consequence of the uprooting of these communities for large-scale resource development, and by the fact that the state fails to provide for and meet their needs on an equitable level in the same way as they would for other peoples. And indigenous activists who speak out for these rights find themselves in the crosshairs as a consequence. So we see a history of assassination and disappearances of indigenous leaders. This is a country which Canada has entered into a free trade agreement for the express purpose of increasing the involvement of Canadian companies, especially in the resource industries in Colombia. We work with the National Indigenous Peoples Organization of Colombia, ONIC, and ONIC has said, if investment is to increase in Colombia, hand in hand with that, there has to go concrete, real protections for the lives, safety, and lands of indigenous peoples. And they've said, as a consequence, they want to see respect for and full implementation and enforcement of the UN Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. And I think that's really interesting. We hear from communities, just utterly, and under such grave threat, saying, from their point of view, the solution is written out in the words of the UN Declaration. On the other end of that, the pole, on the other side of that free trade agreement, if we look in Canada, we can name any number of cases where Indigenous peoples have pursued every possible means for the protection of their rights and yet are still exposed to the same injustices. We've worked alongside the Lubicon Cree. The Lubicon Cree, 21 years ago, went to the United Nations Human Rights Council. One of the human rights mechanisms that oversees the implementation, the adherence to one of the key human rights treaties, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. And they went to this body, and this body considered their case very carefully and found that, in fact, the government of Canada had failed to uphold their rights. What was happening was the Lubicon had never entered into a treaty. They had never entered into any agreement by which the lands and resources might be shared with other people. They were, however, being treated as if they had no rights whatsoever. Instead of the government first negotiating with them, and then as a consequence of those negotiations, however they worked out, then possibly having access to those lands, they just went ahead as if the Lubicons had no rights and licensed massive oil and gas development on their land to the point that it all but eradicated their ability to live off the land. This went right to the level of the United Nations, and a decision was made that said, Canada is violating their rights. 21 years later, the situation remains unchanged. And in fact, if anything, we see a further acceleration as we pursue a model of economic development that sees increasing oil and gas development to fuel the national economy by exporting that gas abroad. And so the pressures upon this community constantly increasing, the number of oil and gas wells on their territory constantly increasing, but no greater protection for their rights.
What about other rights? I'm thinking of, for instance, Shannon's Dream. Not everyone here might know about Shannon's Dream, and I know that our NDP member of the legislative, Charlie Angus, he's been working on this for a couple of years up in Northern Ontario, Attawapiskat, is that where it's at? Yeah, it was a young woman who, very young woman, and was at junior high school. I think she was about 14 or 15 years old, who decided to fight for the right to have a new school built because the school was moldy and falling apart, as far as I remember. And Shannon had a dream that they would try and raise money for a new school because the government had been promising for years that they would build a new school. Would you like to speak to that?
Yeah, Shannon's Dream is a campaign organized in Shannon's memory because of the leadership of this young woman who very, very sadly, very tragically died in an accident. But she was one of the young people who came forward to tell the story of her school and to connect with other young people and push for a basic right, which is the right to education. And the right to education is more than simply having any old form of school available. It's a school that's safe, that's adequate, a school that the children can go to and actually have the proper tools to learn in a proper environment. You know, whenever we raise any issue of human rights in Canada in respect to Aboriginal peoples, what we hear back from the government and what we hear back from a certain segment of the population as well is, but look at all the money that's spent, right? And it's very easy to give that response because when it comes to First Nations people especially, when it comes to the money that is provided for government services is almost all spent through one government department. So very easy to say, look how much money is spent, and it creates a false comparison because we don't compare the money that is spent in First Nations education accurately the amount of money that is spent on education for non-Aboriginal people. But education is one of the areas of very basic human rights where, in fact, if you do the proper comparison of the total resources that are available, you see that the resources are there. First of all, less money is being spent to meet the needs of First Nations. Secondly, it is actually failing to meet the needs. Shannon's Dream is a campaign organized by the First Nations Child and Family Caring Society. And it's like another campaign which they've also organized, again on a very similar theme, which is the issue of the provision of services for Aboriginal child welfare. Today in Canada, despite the fact that there has been a formal apology on behalf of the nation for the residential school program, we actually see today greater numbers of First Nations children being taken from their families and communities than ever before. And according to government studies, government reviews, the work of the Auditor General of Canada and others, the central reason is that children's services in First Nations communities are being underfunded to the point that the action of taking children away, which is supposed to be the last resort, only to be used when you've done everything else to try and meet that child's needs within the family, within the community, that last resort has become the first resort because it's the cheapest option. And it's because of a failure, first of all, to provide funding for Aboriginal child welfare, for First Nations child welfare, on an equitable basis as non-Aboriginal children. Estimates are that approximately 20% less per child is spent. But the other thing is, it also falls far short of needs. Here we're talking about the delivery of services in sometimes remote communities where the expense of delivering the service is higher, small communities where the expense may be higher, and also where, because of that same history, that history of the residential school, among other forms of uprooting and the upheaval experienced by First Nations in Canada, do you see a much greater need? I want to say, well, actually, one more thing about that example, because I think this is really interesting. It goes back to that point you made earlier, Mona, about whether national human rights systems are adequate. After years of trying to resolve this issue, the First Nations Child and Family Caring Society and the Assembly of First Nations took this case to the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal to try and get a ruling that would say this is discrimination and therefore it must end and adequate funding has to be provided. The government of Canada fought tooth and nail against this case, not on its merits, not on the fact that they are underfunding, not on the consequences for these children, but on legal technicalities. And they've tried to present the argument that the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal cannot apply the Canadian Human Rights Act to this principal relationship between the federal government and First Nations, which is the relationship of funding and through the funding formula setting the boundaries, setting the possibilities of what services can be provided. They've said, no, that doesn't fall under the Human Rights Act. The Human Rights Act covers services, not the funding of services. And if they succeed in this, and this is what they're trying to do, they will drive a loophole through the Canadian Human Rights Act that will essentially deny the protection of that act to First Nations across the country in relation to the most crucial form of government interaction, which is the decisions about what services are available in those communities. And so this is an example where, you know, here we have a struggle right within our own domestic human rights system over respect for human rights. Amnesty International, among other organizations, intervened in this case. And this is a case where the importance of international human rights standards is underlined because we tried to bring the UN Declaration into this discussion. Because the way things fit together, international human rights standards, one of their purposes is to help interpret national standards. National standards should always be expected to live up to or ideally exceed the international standards. The international standards often give us more content to deal with. They often give us more expert interpretations. They may be the product of greater thought around some of the specific issues. If we look to international standards from the UN Declaration through the Convention on the Rights of the Child, we can see irrefutably that this idea of making a distinction between setting the funding formula and delivering the services is nonsense, because international standards clearly identify that the two are effectively one and the same, and both are part of the state's responsibility. So there's a good example where you try to bring international human rights standards right into those domestic mechanisms to improve those domestic mechanisms, make them do their job.
The word that was going through my head while you were talking about that was splitting hairs. And it seems that that's been going on a lot lately, of splitting hairs, finding excuses and finding reasons to not support these standards. I happen to know that in the city of Regina recently, Aboriginal Family Services lost their funding for their foster care department. It's gone. And they were doing a fairly good job. And it was the only one we have in the city. So between splitting hairs and just outright pulling the funding, where are we going with this with our government? So we can move on from that. All right. One of the things that you've got a blog on the Amnesty website, and one of the things that you've got that I looked up was in August you posted something about Peru's landmark legal recognition of indigenous rights. So did you want to talk a little bit about that? I think that goes back to speaking about land rights and sort of mining and clean water and things like that.
Mm-hmm. It's really interesting. This goes to the issue of free prior informed consent. One of the key overall concepts of the UN Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples is that Indigenous peoples have the right to decide their own futures, to be the ones that make the decisions that are crucial for the fulfillment of their rights. And a key protection is the concept of free, prior, and informed consent. Now, free, prior, and informed consent as a concept, I think a lot of people would argue that this is actually already a part of Canadian law. And it has long been a part of Canadian law. The Royal Proclamation of 1763 talks about the necessity of obtaining the consent of the indigenous peoples of North America before settlers could enter into their lands. That the essence of treaty making, and you see the language reflected in the treaties, is the essence of a treaty is to obtain consent. And you look at both the language of the treaties and you look at the correspondence of the treaty negotiators. They're talking about obtaining consent. So we have this history of recognition of the need to obtain consent. And in fact, the Supreme Court of Canada has said that there's a spectrum of obligations in any decision that could potentially affect the rights of Indigenous peoples. At the very least, there has to be an accommodation of those rights. And where there are serious concerns for the implications, there has to be the obtaining of consent. So you know, from all sides, this should be recognized as already part of Canadian law. But this language of consent in the UN Declaration has been one of the things that the Canadian government has seized on and has claimed to be unreasonable and unacceptable, and why they had to oppose the Declaration initially, why they had to try and mobilize other governments to try to prevent its adoption. When it was adopted, why they themselves refused to endorse it until finally, eventually, they grudgingly turned around and endorsed it, only to say, well, we're still not going to implement it. One of the key issues comes down to consent. Interestingly, we see other governments in the world, and actually not only governments, in fact, some aspects of private industry, as well as international agencies, international financial institutions, all moving ahead with this concept of consent. The Peruvian government has recently passed a law that requires the consent of indigenous peoples before decisions are made about development on their lands and territories. This is the government of Peru was able to do this. And the government of Peru is very much a government. It's a state that's dependent on resource development, yet could recognize the wisdom of doing this. People may know that Talisman Energy, a Calgary-based oil company, that they're under pressure from their shareholders, commissioned a study on free, prior, and informed consent. And it was a business study. And their study looked into the legalities of it and came back with the conclusion that any company that is making investments, that are long-term investments, if you're making investments of projects going to be 5 years, 10 years down the road, you should recognize that free, prior, and informed consent is either already an existing standard or within that 5 to 10 year period will certainly become the operating norm for that time. And so if you're working that time frame, you should be working on that concept of consent. And the other example I'll give is that the World Bank, one of the arms of the World Bank that's involved in the international financial institutions that are involved in funding some of these projects around the world, have themselves just undergone a review. And the first of these institutions just this year also adopted free, prior, and informed consent as their operating principle in respect to development of the lands of indigenous peoples.
And on that note, we're going to do a commercial break, and then we'll come back.
We're back. Now, we'll carry on with Craig, and we're going to get some questions from our audience here at the Regina Unitarian Center.
Thank you. And for those of you who weren't here for the first half of the show, I'd just like to reintroduce our special guest, Craig Benjamin, from Amnesty International head office out of Ottawa. And Craig's been talking about his specialty, Indigenous rights. First half of our program, we talked a lot about the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People, and we're currently going to have a bit of a question period with people from the audience, so I think we have a question over here. I'm going to pass the microphone to Paul.
I've come recently, 5 years ago I came over from Britain, so Canada was a completely different world to me, though I had been working with Native peoples in America. What I do find here is there's a lot of latent racism from the white Canadians, thinking that the native people actually get a better deal. Oh, he should get a job. He should do this. He shouldn't get this handout. Why do they get things that we don't? How do you think that you can make the white Canadians see things differently?
I think it's really interesting that you observe that coming from outside the country. I think this is one of our weaknesses as a society, is that some of these attitudes are so ingrained that we just, the non-Aboriginal people in Canada often simply can't see this kind of racism. We've come to believe so many of these justifications, these excuses for the way things are. I do think there's a couple of ways to come at that. One is we just have to counter with the facts, and I think that that one of the prime examples is to refute this idea that Aboriginal people in Canada are receiving all these great handouts from our government. Like I said, if we actually do the math, if we actually make a proper comparison between the services which non-Aboriginal people enjoy from all levels of government versus the services provided through Indian and Northern Affairs Canada, you see the opposite is true. You see a significant gap in the services. But those kind of factual arguments only go so far. I think really practically one of the key things is that we live in a divided country. We live in a country in which it's very possible for non-Aboriginal people to go through their lives and only know Aboriginal people through the racist stereotypes of the media. And that's a really unfortunate reality. Something I will say, though, that has really moved me, and I think is really significant. One of our areas of campaigning is that we've been working to support Aboriginal women's organizations across the country to focus attention on issues of violence against Aboriginal women, especially the role of Canadian society as a whole in putting Aboriginal women in these situations where they're vulnerable to violence through the marginalization, the discrimination, the failure to provide adequate police protection. All across Canada there's been this movement to hold vigils, to provide other forms of support for Aboriginal women's families. And I've seen in community after community across this country an amazing shift of public opinion, an amazing shift of people coming out, taking part in these vigils, taking part in things like searches when people go missing. And what we have seen is that when we began our research, we did a report called Stolen Sisters. It came out back in 2004, but we're doing the research for it in 2002, 2003. At that time, when we do media searches, we go looking for articles when an Aboriginal woman was murdered, an Aboriginal woman gone missing, and we'd find newspaper articles buried in the back of the paper, a single inch long, not a word of sympathy anywhere in that copy. And today we're seeing what I think is the beginning of a really proper reporting that talks about these women as women who are the sisters or the daughters, loved members of the family, talks about their families with respect as families missing that loved one. It is a significant shift, and we really have seen it in these past few years. And I think that shift has come from the very act of Aboriginal, non-Aboriginal people coming together over this issue, having that opportunity to break down some of those barriers, to really work together, and more than anything else, through the incredible courage of those families who have withstood the pressure of going before the media and telling those stories and letting the world see them as they are, letting the world see them as human beings, as loving parents, as loving sisters and brothers of these missing women. And an act of incredible courage to put yourself forward like that in the midst of your grief. But I think by doing so, that they've really helped, you know, bring people closer together. And I think there's a real sign of hope in that.
Do we have any other questions? Okay, Catherine?
We noticed that the title of this declaration is United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, with an S, which is very significant. Would you speak to that?
It is very significant. And in fact, it's this little thing, that one little letter, S, was at the heart of so much of the controversy over the Declaration. Without that S, the Declaration probably could have been adopted long ago, but would have far less significance, far less meaning. The international human rights system, the two of the core instruments are the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights and International Covenant on Economic and Social and Cultural Rights. Both of those two covenants begin with the right of self-determination. Both of them begin by saying all peoples have the right of self-determination. As a consequence of that right, have the right to choose a government representative of the people. As a consequence of that right, shall never be denied the means of subsistence. As a consequence of that right, will have sovereignty over their natural resources. These are fundamental concepts, not only of the human rights system, but of the United Nations system as a whole. All peoples, with an S. Peoples meaning nations, societies. Right? The argument was that although it said all peoples, that indigenous peoples should be excluded from that. The argument was that indigenous peoples did not meet the criteria, did not qualify to be considered peoples under international law, solely as a consequence of the fact that they had been colonized, solely as a consequence of the fact that an external sovereignty had been imposed upon them. It was a long struggle in the Declaration there were efforts by many states to not recognize that universal right of all peoples should apply to indigenous peoples. There were efforts to create a new special subcategory, a lesser category of self-determination that would apply only to indigenous peoples. And there was actually an attempt by states to enshrine in a human rights standard that kind of discrimination, that kind of double standard against indigenous peoples, to say that, you know, while all peoples have the right of self-determination, indigenous peoples have something less. At the end of the day, indigenous peoples and their supporters triumphed, and the UN Declaration is utterly explicit. It exactly mirrors the language of the two international covenants and affirms that indigenous peoples, like all peoples, have that right of self-determination. And the key thing is in that S, because without the S, when you say all people, when you talk about people, you just mean a collection, any of us here in this room. Well, we're all people. To talk about peoples is to talk about nations as nations. There is that inherent right to set your own course, to set your own destiny.
Anyone else?
Thank you for the question.
Okay, Norm?
I have a question about the Lubicon. It seems to me that I've been hearing about the Lubicons and their situation for 30 years or more, and I've been involved in writing on their behalf over that period to governments in Alberta and governments in Canada. And nothing seems to have ever been done to change the situation. And the Lubicon were without a reservation, without a reserve, there's good precedent for Aboriginal people being granted a reserve in fairly recent times. And so I'm wondering why nothing could ever be done, and I'm wondering if... if the governments knew that the oil sands development was coming and they didn't want to disturb that by setting up a reserve in the middle of it, what kind of pressure was on them? What accounts for this absolute obstructionism towards this?
Well, the Lubicon Cree, it's an indigenous people, around 500 people. They live about 5 hours north of Edmonton, or to an hour away from Peace River. They are, in fact, in the midst of an area that is currently slated for the next major wave of oil sands development. The wave was called the in-situ development, where water steams, it's pressured into the ground to release the oil sands. They have already endured, exactly as you said, 3 decades of massive oil and gas development on their land. So there's more oil and gas wells than there are people. In fact, there are 5 times more oil and gas wells on the land than there are people. The Lubicon are in a very interesting situation because while a treaty was negotiated with indigenous peoples in that region, the Lubicon themselves were utterly left out. They were not included. So they never gave their consent, and they never gave up any land, never entered into a treaty. And the position taken by governments initially was that they had no rights, that they didn't even belong there, that they were squatters on the land. They eventually recognized them as indigenous peoples of that land, that it was their land. The government has taken a number of contradictory positions, including saying, well, even though they weren't part of the treaty process, even though they were never informed of the treaty process, even though they never agreed to the treaty process, they're just covered by it anyway, because we want them to be covered by it. And therefore, all they are entitled to are the terms of the treaty. When I said about the UN Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, that if indigenous peoples had been willing to settle for secondary rights, for lesser rights, they could have gotten a declaration decades ago. But they held on for the full realization of their rights. I really think that that's the heart of the story of the Lubicon. I think it is true the federal government has a very, after the initial period of utterly denying their existence and wanting to completely run over them, the government did come to a position saying, well, we are willing to recognize a reserve. But where the Lubicon and the federal government have never been able to come to agreement is on 2 key issues. One is the compensation that they're owed for the destruction of their culture, for the destruction of their lands. It's hard to say whether the federal government has come up with the kinds of compensation they've offered, because they've never explained where they're coming up with the numbers from. The Lubicon have looked at it in any number of ways, from saying, half of 1% of royalties of the value of this gas, the monies you haven't been giving to us for the last 100 years for basic services, this is the amount of money we calculate we need to establish a viable community to provide jobs for our children in the future. Any number of formulas, and the federal government has always come back with much, much, much lower offers that would never meet basic standards of justice. The other thing is that the federal government has never been willing to accept that the Lubicon would have a degree of control over their lives and their future that they want. And it goes back again a little bit to this issue about the lack of a treaty. In situations such as where the government has been willing to acknowledge that in fact that people are without a treaty and there's a need to negotiate a treaty, there are self-government provisions within that. The federal government has never fully acknowledged that the Lubicon are a people without a treaty. The federal government has never fully acknowledged that there are people who retain an Aboriginal title to their land. As a consequence, has never really agreed to negotiate with them on the basis of a modern treaty or a comprehensive treaty process. And they've always tried to restrict the terms of negotiations to a much lesser set of rights. I don't know how the Lubicon themselves have been able to hold on this long. The pressures to agree to lesser rights must be absolutely enormous. Your point that this has been going on and people have been speaking out and yet we don't see a change, I think is absolutely true. I also think it's even more important today than ever before, precisely because of the oil sands, precisely because after all this history of massive conventional oil and gas development, and the Lubicon holding on despite that, could they survive the kind of intensive additional development of oil sands activity on their land? Seems so crucial just to struggle for them to have that say, that right to say no to that development, and the right to be able to have a fair share of other forms of development on their land.
Are there any other questions? Okay, Corey.
The question I have is, what are some of the legal ramifications, like if a nation was to adopt the UN Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples legally into their systems, what are some of the ramifications of that?
There's a couple ways. It depends on where you're going with the question, I guess. Because for example, you're talking about an indigenous people, a First Nation, adopting the declaration for their own use, effectively to help, is a way of defining and shaping the enjoyment of rights within their own, within their own control. I think that's exactly what we would hope to see happening, because these human rights instruments, they're not just out there for the federal government of Canada to honor and uphold. They're out there for all levels and all forms of governments, all institutions. The very fact that Indigenous peoples themselves really were the architects and authors of the Declaration, we'd really hope to see, as a consequence, Indigenous nations themselves really taking this on. And there's some really important provisions in here that relate, and I'll give maybe a couple of examples of them. The Declaration deals with the right to education. It also deals with the need to provide particular protections for the most vulnerable members of society, and particularly highlights the need to address violence against women. The Declaration has strong provisions around language, the necessity of keeping children within their family and their culture and their community. We can see all of these as having real practical ramifications for how one chooses to manage your community, your society, your nation. The other side of the legal ramifications is using the Declaration as a tool to protect rights, in respect to or against the federal government, against provincial and territorial governments, or against corporations. Important thing to understand about international human rights instruments is that they don't stand on their own. And the only reason they don't stand on their own is they don't have enforcement mechanisms. You can believe in this with all of your heart, but you need to connect it to something else to genuinely make it viable. Fortunately, and this goes back to the question Mona had asked earlier about the relationship between international standards and national, whether it's courts, human rights commissions, other institutions, is that there's the basic principle that any form of government anywhere in the world should seek to live up to the highest international standards, to live up to and exceed those standards. Courts in Canada have said that we should expect that our laws should be interpreted in the light of international standards and live up to and meet those standards. So that we can see that when people are before the courts defending their rights, that they can use the Declaration to help interpret them. When they're in discussion of how to make a treaty negotiated in 1874 alive and relevant and protect people's rights today in 2011, the Declaration can be part of how one reads and interprets that. If you're struggling before the Human Rights Commission, a Human Rights Commission to say, we want fair and equitable funding to ensure that our children receive the basic services they need, the Declaration can be read into that and used to help interpret those standards. And because, frankly, in this, again, back to this question, so many of the existing standards were developed and imposed upon Indigenous peoples without awareness, without concern for Indigenous peoples' own view and interpretation of their rights. The UN Declaration can help be kind of a correcting mechanism to help bring that understanding back into the room.
So if the Declaration was to be adopted at an international judicial level, what sorts of enforcements are there at that particular level? Like, it just seems like there's no teeth there.
No, that is true. There's very few international mechanisms that really have teeth, and notably, one of the strongest is the Inter-American Court of Human Rights, and it's a court that Indigenous peoples in Latin America have been used very successfully to advocate for their rights. That court does have far more teeth, really, than any other human rights mechanism, but Canada has not ratified the conventions necessary for that court to apply to Canada. So the reality is that the enforcement of something like the UN Declaration takes place really in three ways. It takes place on a legal arena in conjunction with other laws and standards, in conjunction with things like human rights tribunals, in conjunction with the legal protections that exist in a treaty, for example. The protections afforded by the Declaration exist at a political level because there is real political weight to something like this, when a government does, you know, put its name to something like this, when it says it endorses it, when it makes a commitment, it's a political pledge that they can be pressured within Parliament to uphold. They can be pressured by other governments to uphold it, and it's a moral, and there's the moral weight of a declaration. And you know, from the point of view of Amnesty International, whose real work over the decades has been the work of ordinary people putting moral pressure on governments to live up to these standards. I mean, I can tell you with absolute sincerity and conviction that moral pressure does work, and that combination of political, legal, and moral pressure can be really significant. I do think of the fact that, you know, after fighting tooth and nail against the Declaration and denouncing it as a threat to the very survival of nations, the fact that Canada would turn around and endorse the Declaration is exactly evidence of that power of moral pressure, of political pressure. And I think that that's part of where we need to go. But one other comment, when you talked about, you know, I think that's one of the other real values of more and more Indigenous nations themselves taking on the Declaration, bringing the Declaration to life within their own communities, within their own practices, is that also it sets that moral example and it creates that pressure for states to comply.
Any more questions? Larry.
Arguably, the human race is now facing the most challenging problem that we have ever faced with climate change and the consequences of it. And it's interesting to note that many of the resources that are complicating this issue are on Indigenous land. So I'd just like you to maybe address how Amnesty views this issue and just your opinions on that idea.
I think you've actually named the key elements right there. I mean, as an organization, we have quite clearly said that the climate change is a human rights issue, that the impacts of climate change have a dire potential consequences for the enjoyment of basic human rights, including the ability of people to feed themselves. So it is absolutely a human rights issue. It also is an issue that quite often plays out right on the ground in very specific ways. And we talk about, you know, resource development projects and their direct implications on the lives of people whose lands are being developed. We have a particular focus on the issue of free prior informed consent, the right of Indigenous peoples to decide for themselves what development will proceed on their land. And I think that, you know, recognition of that right is one piece that would go a long way toward restoring balance in decision-making processes. The other thing I think is really, really significant, and it goes kind of to the point of, again, of the S in peoples and that struggle for recognition of peoples. Peoples are nations, are peoples with self-determination under international law. They're also international actors. And that was one of the other messages the Indigenous peoples brought to the world in the negotiation of the Declaration. It said that, you know, we are not only exercising our right of self-determination locally in the governance of our own immediate affairs, we're exercising that right of self-determination by engaging on the world stage. Because the world in which we live in, we have to engage on the world stage. We cannot confine or contain the exercise of our rights only to that immediate sphere of the boundaries of our territory, because that's not how the world works any longer. We have to be able to exercise our right of self-determination by coming to the United Nations, by having a seat at the table in discussions over things like climate change, over things like the future of Arctic development. And that was such a strong message of the Declaration. And I think that that's one of the really interesting implications of the kind of model that was set by the way in which the Declaration was negotiated. And it's one of the implications of the recognition of Indigenous peoples as peoples, is that opportunity for Indigenous peoples really to play that kind of role and to really engage in these kinds of discussions. And it really is already happening around cross-border environmental effects, for example, around circumpolar issues. And I think this really, in many ways, is the way of the future. And it has to be. It absolutely has to be, for exactly the reasons you said, the urgency of the situations we face.
I think we're going to wrap up the question period now. And what have we got left? 2 minutes left. So what we're going to do is, we're not necessarily going to end this right away, because I still wanted to ask Craig to speak a little bit about the Stolen Sisters campaign. He mentioned it earlier that this is something that Amnesty's been involved in, and we put out the Stolen Sisters report. And we will sort of segment this into future shows, if you don't mind. Could you talk a little bit about that? And we'll also let you know that the vigil that we have every year is coming up on October 4th. I believe that's Tuesday, isn't it? At Victoria Park in downtown Regina. And 6:30 in the evening. So if you could give us a little bit of information about the history of Stolen Sisters, Craig.
Sure. Our work on this campaign called Stolen Sisters really began back in 2002, 2003, when we were approached by the Native Women's Association of Canada that was very deeply engaged in trying to bring public attention, public awareness to the scale, the severity, and the range of violence facing Aboriginal women in Canada. Since that time, the Native Women's Association has been able to document 600 or more cases over the last two decades of Aboriginal women who have been murdered or who have been missing for so long that their families fear for their lives. More than 600 in two decades in a country like Canada that overall has very low crime rates. That is a really, really appallingly high number. It's backed up by the limited statistics we have available federally from the Government of Canada. Various studies by Statistics Canada have said that Aboriginal women in Canada face 3 to 5 times higher rates of violence than non-Aboriginal women, are 3 to 5 times more likely to die as a result of violence. I say limited statistics because, in fact, police forces in Canada do not routinely or systematically record whether or not the victims of violent crime are Aboriginal or not, and don't compile this information. Effectively, the Government of Canada isn't keeping track of the deaths and disappearances of Aboriginal women. People ask all the time, what's the real number? It's indicative of the situation that we don't know. We have this incredibly high rate of violence, and yet we have a state which keeps track of everything else imaginable, keeps so many statistics, doesn't bother to keep track here. And then I think that tells us something about the disregard for the basic value of the lives of these sisters and daughters who've gone missing. The very essence of our work in support of the Native Women's Association, the support of families who have lost sisters and daughters, is to try to change that, is to try and shift public consciousness to recognize the inherent value of all of these lives, that these are women who are loved and valued and who are missed today, and it's unacceptable to us that those risks are out there, and we need to do something about it. And I want to say something really, really clearly about this, because one of the responses we get around this issue is that so many people will, upon hearing about this, will turn around and point the finger right back at Aboriginal people. And say, well, that's Aboriginal people's problem to fix, right? And clearly, the solution lies with Aboriginal people. But it is not their problem alone. It's a societal problem. We look at the reasons why the rates of violence are so high. So much of it has to do with the ways in which Canadian society has failed Aboriginal women. The fundamental gaps in standard of living that put Aboriginal women at risk of violence. The fact that the pervasive racism, a long history of racism, the racist stereotypes of Aboriginal women in Canada has led men to target Aboriginal women. And I think this is clearly demonstrated by the nature of the crimes, the horrific brutality of the crimes, the fact that in so many of the cases, some of the instances we looked at, the women were not the targets of a single lone extreme perpetrator, but targeted by groups of men, or by a man who went back and bragged to his friends about what he did, all of which tells us this violence is taking place in a context in which those men feel it's socially acceptable to act out that misogyny, to act out that racism on the bodies of Aboriginal women. And third, the failure of police forces, as indicated by the fact that they're not even keeping track of the information, let alone in a systematic way across the country, putting in place the procedures necessary to address this. We have worked alongside the Native Women's Association of Canada and the Assembly of First Nations, organizations like Kairos and many, many others, to call for a concerted national plan of action that is in keeping with the scale and the severity and widespread nature of this violence. It seems obvious that this is necessary. And in fact, this summer, Canada went to the United Nations and championed a resolution at the UN Human Rights Council calling upon all governments in the world to adopt national plans of action to address violence against women that include the collection of adequate data to inform those plans of action.
This is what they call upon all governments of the world. And even though they themselves acknowledge that Aboriginal women in Canada face much greater risk, face the highest incidence of violence, when asked whether or not Canada would heed the call for a national plan of action, the Minister for the Status of Women, Rona Ambrose, said, "We're already doing enough."
As well as cutting funding to the Native Women's Organization. Thank you, Craig. I think we'll wrap up the show now. Thank you very much for your attendance. Thank you for joining us, Craig.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Wonderful having you. And Jim, did you want to sign off?
As we close this week's Human Rights Radio on CJTR Community Radio, we hope you've enjoyed listening to and have learned something new about human rights for all people. To discover how you can contribute to the abolition of human rights violations, visit our website at amnestysaskatchewan.ca or check out our Facebook group at Amnesty International Saskatchewan and follow the links. Peter Benenson, the founder of Amnesty International, often said, "It's better to light a candle of hope than to curse the darkness."